Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Hi, I'm Paul Listick, and welcome to Behind the Curtain. Another busy week in Washington and around the globe. Let's tackle some of the critical issues, and maybe not some so critical issues, but they're nevertheless on the front burner of our country for some reason. We'll explore that with Professor Philip Beverly. He's an associate professor of political science at Chicago State University, a regular guest on Politics Tonight, and returning to the podcast. Professor, welcome back. Good to talk to you.
Hey, Paul, how are you?
I am good, and hope you are. You know, the reference I was making to, you know, issues that are on the front burner but shouldn't be, as you know, the president, when he was in Arizona at a rally, brought up this notion of it's wrong for people to go on their knee, and what he equated that to was disrespecting the flag and disrespecting the national anthem. He continued that in a press conference he had with the prime minister of Spain. So he's not going to back off of that position at all. My question to you is, I guess it's twofold. Number one, why has this become now an issue of national importance when we've got North Korea and health care and taxes and everything else going on? All of a sudden, this is where the focus is. You know, the president, whatever you think of him, tends to do things kind of strategically, I think. Can you explain why we find ourselves in this position?
I think because he doesn't have anything in terms of policy on the issues that you mentioned. So he can't get a win on North Korea because he thinks that a win only comes through sort of bully boy tactics and sort of hard power. And the only way that we're going to get anything on North Korea is multilateral negotiations that include the Chinese. And we better listen to what they want in this deal. It doesn't mean we give it to them, but we have to at least participate in a process. And this is an easy topic because he is so divisive a figure, it's an easy one to go to be divisive with.
You know, you say he's divisive. He says he's a uniter. And in fact, over the previous weekend, Sunday morning shows, when you had Treasurer or Secretary Steve Mnuchin, he said, no, this whole topic, it's a uniting speech. It's a bringing people around the flag and the national anthem. So everybody who thinks it's a divider is wrong.
Yeah, and Steve Mnuchin doesn't have a clue what he's talking about, unfortunately. I would say in the past week, look at the number and type of protests waged by professional athletes, and now it's leaving the NFL and going to other sports as well. You know, we've got two major sports starting seasons, regular seasons upcoming, and who's to say what the NBA is going to look like at the beginning of their season? This is not going to work out well in terms of trying to unite. And I just have to say, I didn't know that we weren't united around the flag. I didn't know we weren't united around the national anthem, for example. That seems to be a little troubling that we're making an issue out of something that isn't an issue.
You know, during a press conference the president held during the week with the prime minister of Spain, he was asked whether or not, you know, that this issue should have been focused on and as opposed to the hurricanes and Puerto Rico's devastation, all that kind of thing. And part of the president's answer, you know, he doesn't mean exactly what this is going to say, but it was just sort of he said, no, he absolutely was not distracted. He was not, you know, he has plenty of time on his hands. So he has plenty of time to handle all of these things and the NFL, and this was an issue. I was just curious to get your reaction to kind of the phrase, whether he meant it or not, but nevertheless, I've got plenty of time on my hands.
Yeah, that's sort of a ridiculous thing because from what I've understood about the presidency over the last almost 30 years that I've been studying it, it is the most difficult job in the world, and there's never enough time for all of the issues that face that come into the White House. There's just never enough time, and I think incumbents or former presidents will tell you about the difficulty of the job, and you see how it ages everybody who's done that job.
Oh yeah,
so big time. I don't think he really grasps the significance significance of the job yet.
The NFL, of course, doesn't want to be a political organization. They do have rules about, and in the past they've dealt with honoring the Dallas police officers who were killed during those riots, and they were not allowed to put an armband on. They wanted to do something about breast cancer when one of the players' mothers passed away. They weren't allowed to wear something pink. And I know the NFL has various rules about different things, but how do you square not respecting those kinds of political issues with the wearing of an armband with, in this case, player or players' desires to say, look, I've got it. This isn't about the flag, by the way. This is about Black Lives Matter and those other issues. They're just choosing to do it the way they do it. It's a freedom of speech issue. I think a lot of people would argue, not everybody agrees. But what's the difference if the NFL is saying you can't do that, but you get to do this?
I think the major difference with the NFL right now is in those other two instances, you were talking about alterations to uniform policy, and the NFL has been pretty adamant about maintaining uniform integrity, no matter what the issue was. They don't want alterations to the uniform. And I think it, from their perspective, it's a brand protection issue that they don't want to have everybody's issues suddenly become placed on the, if you imagine the uniforms as billboards for their brand, they don't want everybody's issue sort of being advertised there. This kind of protest, though, and a more direct action, taking a knee or not standing for the national anthem, not coming out of the locker room, is very different. And I think it's also one that they can't, without collective bargaining, can't enforce any changes to it, because I think the Players Association would say, look, that's a change in working conditions, and you got to negotiate that with us.
I also got to be blunt in asking this question. You know, it has been a constant source of discussion as to whether the president's bringing this issue up in Alabama in front of a mostly, if not almost all, white audience, was about race and was about triggering discussion of race. The president says, no, it had nothing to do with race. It has to do with honoring the flag. And the thing is, I know it's easy to go there. I know it's easy to just, it's race, you know, because everything else he does has to do with race, whatever. But he says no. He says it's about honoring the flag. And, you know, he does get a lot of support in the country of people who believe the flag and the national anthem need to be honored. So, I mean, is it really fair to say this was race, or is it just a way for anti-Trump people to plug into another attack on the president on that issue?
Well, if this president had been judged to be a man of goodwill and good intention, you might think twice about that. But he's got a record now, especially after Charlottesville and the UVA incidents that occurred there, of not really being trusted around his denial that this has anything, and the White House's denial that this has anything to do with race. I'm a bit dubious about that. I think it's given where he made the comments, who he made the comments in front of, and some of the other sort of coded language that he and his surrogates have used around this, that this is definitely about race. And I think that there's a I'm not going to say longstanding, but some belief in some quarters that, you know, professional athletes should just be happy that they're allowed to make money here. And it's like, why would professional athletes, many of whom in the NFL are African American, suddenly need to be thankful that their talents in the United States of America would somehow need to be treated with such disregard?
Let's give him credit and say it's all about the national anthem, it's all about the flag. I think he triggered a lot of reaction too when he used the SOB term and all of that, and they should be fired. Would there have been a proper way for everybody where he could have addressed this to say, look, I think it's disrespectful, you shouldn't do it? I mean, was part of it the rhetoric used and the tone?
Yeah, because he's an inflammatory, divisive sort of character. And the whole thinking that this is, and this is my interpretation, that this is a reality TV show that he's running and you can just fire people who have contracts, is playing to a television audience and not really being helpful in advancing any kind of national dialogue around the issue. And I think given the divided political environment that we find ourselves in, shame on him for doing that. I mean, okay, you've got your base that you have to sort of appeal to, but sometimes there's going to be issues that are going to be larger than your base. And you're going to have to tell them, this is a larger issue than that, yeah, and we need to address this.
Well, whether it is or isn't about that, one of the things it has been is a distraction from critical issues. I want to turn to one of those, which is healthcare. So there were a minimum 3 no votes, Susan Collins, John McCain, Rand Paul, and, of course, the Mitch McConnell decides we're pulling the bill, we're not even putting it up for a vote. I guess my question is, can we now expect Republicans and Democrats to work together as they had begun to do? Senator Lamar Alexander, Republican, Senator Patty Murray, Democrat, began to work together in a bipartisan way to fix things. Does this mean the Affordable Care Act is on its way to fix and repair? Or if, for example, John McCain were to leave the Senate, you know, he said on 60 Minutes the prognosis for his health is not good, and we wish him years and years of good health. But if he were to retire or otherwise have to leave the Senate, are the Republicans just waiting for a moment like that to go, and then we're bringing it back again because he's been that final vote?
Well, I think it's they still have to deal with a senator like Senator Heller in Nevada. They still have to deal with Senator Murkowski. They still have to deal with Senator Collins. And I think that people are going to tire of the, you know, repeal and replace rhetoric when they...
Well, they're not. Are they tired yet? I mean, are they not tired yet, Philip? I mean, it's been 60-some times and efforts.
And now, well, when President Obama was in office, you knew that it was going nowhere. But now you've got the control of all the mechanisms of government, and you still can't get it done. And at some point, get something done. They have to get a win.
Is it a win? If Republicans and Democrats, if they work together and actually repair Obamacare and fix some of the problems, is that a win?
I think it is a win. I think you can sell that to a large number of independent voters. You may not sell it to the more rabid Republican base voters, but I think for those swing voters that you really need in close elections, I think that they will get that. Bipartisanship on something this critical, I think, gets them a win.
And we'll see how that plays out. I want to turn to North Korea for a moment. Tensions escalating on a regular basis, probably partially or primarily, I think, because of the rhetoric being used by the leaders of both countries. What is your sense? I mean, you study the presidency, you know, it's certainly not the way President Kennedy handled the Cuban Missile Crisis. Where's this thing headed?
I unfortunately have to trust that China does not want this to expand much beyond, in a rhetorical sense, where we're at right now. And it's a lot is going to fall on them. They're going to have to decide how far are they going to let their you know, sort of surrogate state progress with this inflammatory rhetoric. The launching of intercontinental ballistic test missiles in the Pacific only is going to destabilize the region, and that's going to hurt China's economy. They've got to see that there's an economic cost that they're going to end up having to pay here, and I don't think that they're going to want to do that considering their economy is starting to slow a little bit.
Finally, and just briefly, but the Congress is supposed to turn their attention to tax reform. Paul Ryan says they're going to do it. We'll be seeing the plans for such going forward. But it looks like even that one probably doesn't see much of the light of day because they really talk about the significant cuts for individuals and corporations they're talking about. There'll be dissension within their own party once again.
Oh, absolutely. I think that this is going to be a lot of discussion and not too much is going to get substantively altered in terms of the tax code. I would imagine that the corporate tax rates may go down a bit. There might be some symbolic stuff added in personal income tax, some exemptions or some ease of filing or something, but nothing really substantive. And I hate to say this, but you know, when you've got a national debt as large as ours is cutting, you know, personal income tax the best way to do this? Is cutting corporate income tax the best way to help our economy, or should we start trying to pay down some of this debt?
Well, I imagine the response to that from Republicans when the time comes will be, Well, yeah, it's short-term increase in debt, but we're spurring so much economic growth that all that stuff is going to go away, which sounds very much like what we heard in the 1980s under the Reagan days.
And we see that that's really failed us. And what we've looked at and are seeing in this recovery from 2008-2009 is a sort of jobless recovery. Wages and salaries aren't going up except at the highest levels. And so this idea that the economy is going to be spurred to some high growth, I'm not seeing that. That's not what the economic indicators are showing us.
All right. Hey, by the way, over at Chicago State University, had a lot of financial problems. The state passed a budget. Things getting more comfortable over there?
Slightly, but, you know, we've got years of neglect and infrastructure neglect here, not just at CSU, but I think in higher ed across the state. And so we're going to need to take a look at how we stabilize that here and protect our economic growth at the state level.
And we'll keep an eye on it with you. Professor Philip Beverly, Associate Professor of Political Science at Chicago State University. Thanks for your insight, sir. As always, I appreciate it. We'll see you again soon on the podcast and on TV.
Thanks, Paul.
Take care.
Bye.
Well, and as always, in the second part of the podcast, love to look at a great show that's going on in the Chicago area. As I always like to say, not everything is downtown. One of the Broadway hits, those are great, and they're wonderful. And not everything even has to be over at the wonderful Goodman and Steppenwolf and such. If you just check out other theaters in the city, you're going to come across Pride Films and Plays, which we've had them on before. We've talked about that. David Zack, the founder, a longtime friend of mine, and they do great stuff. Well, right now, there is the Chicago premiere of a show called Perfect Arrangement. It actually has been off Broadway. It's won tons of awards. So glad that it's here. And in seeing it recently, I was stunned. I wasn't really stunned, but I imagine some people will be stunned at how this story from the early 1950s, specifically 1951, actually could be told today and today's environment. That may be the point. We're going to find out because joining me, the playwright from Atlanta, I think that's where you are, Topher Payne, who's won tons of awards for this. Topher, thanks for joining us. You're in Atlanta now, right?
I am indeed. It's so good to be with you.
I appreciate it. And by the way, okay, before I get to our other guests, I have to just, my understanding is, and I've read this, you have written movies for the Hallmark Channel that are going to get in the way of my watching I Love Lucy and Frasier throughout this entire upcoming Christmas season. Those damn Hallmark movies, you're responsible for three of them.
I am absolutely responsible for those damn Hallmark movies.
Well, congratulations. I just want you to know when it's on, I'm going to watch it because you wrote it and I'm going to love it, but I'm really going to be missing Frasier and I Love Lucy.
You know, you can get those on DVD.
Yeah, I've got them all on DVD. That's not the point. You got to watch them when they're actually on, too. It's the live experience. Okay, I think the other guests are probably wanting to chime in on this very same point. So joining us also is the director of the show, Derek Van Barum, middle name Van, I might note. And Derek, thanks for joining me, and great job on directing the show. And do you agree that you'd rather watch I Love Lucy than not Topher's, but generic Hallmark movies?
I am happy to be here, and I could not agree more.
Okay. And one of my favorite actors in this city. Every time he does something, I want him to come on the podcast because I just become a big fan of his, and I just love his work. And there's this character that is part of him on stage that intrigues me, and I enjoy so much. Lane Anthony Flores is joining us again. You were on for a previous show, Lane. Welcome back.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
All right. So for those, and this again is playing at Pride Films and Plays up on Broadway, 4139 North Broadway. I'll say this again, but you've got until about October 22nd to see it. Although I should say, any chance of an extension, Derek?
Not currently. I don't think so. What we've kind of been finding with having our own space and renting to other people is that we don't have the option of just going for as long as we want to.
Gotcha. So people need to see it by October. So don't wait. Yeah, get your tickets for October 22nd. Again, and when I was there, man, there was just the audience so varied, so different, old, young, different generations, all getting an interesting message. But let's set this out. Topher, you wrote it, and I'm going to start it this way. When I first saw it, I suspected it was something you wrote in this time of Trump, which listeners will understand as you describe it. But I understand from Derek, actually, the process of writing this was pre-Trump, so that really wasn't the impetus in writing it, or is that not true?
That is correct. That is correct. You know, that's the wonderful thing about theater is that it's a living, breathing thing. And our words shift in context as the times can change significantly. So I started writing this early in the Obama administration. We had our world premiere in 2013. And then it has taken on new context as the world shifts around us.
Yeah, so tell my listeners, tell us what the show is about, because I'll be curious as we hear what it's about, what led you to go after this in 2013 when things were getting better for certain parts of society?
Absolutely. It tells the story of Bob and Norma, who are two State Department employees. They are on the Personnel Security Board, which was originally assigned the task of rooting out potential communist threats within their ranks. That mission proved so successful that they expanded the definition of security risk to include drunkards, loose women, and suspected homosexuals. And Bob and Norma are now placed in this position where they felt they were doing something very patriotic, and unbeknownst to the State Department, Bob and Norma are now hunting for themselves. They've married each other's respective partners as this elaborate cover to maintain their jobs and maintain positions in Washington society in the early 1950s. And so it becomes a story about the farce and frustration of attempting to pass.
And that's the story that we get out again. It takes place, but as you're sitting and watching it, and I know that I turned to the friend I was with and I said, my God, this is today's story. You don't even have to make all that much adjustment to it. And you're there. Derek, as you directed this show, was that on your mind, or were you were aware of the fact that Topher started writing this in the Obama days? So what affected you as you put the show together as a director?
Oh, sure. We had an earlier draft, being Pride Films and Plays, a couple of years ago when we were working on another of Topher's plays. So it's kind of been near the top of the list for a few seasons. And, you know, for different planning purposes, it didn't work out last year. And then it was off Broadway. So, Topher was off being famous, so we couldn't touch it for a little bit.
Making his hallmark in society.
Yes, hallmark on society. But unfortunately, I do think this is probably the most relevant time we could be doing it. And I think it's coming at a time where the world has sort of shifted around us, where all theater, inherently is political. And now just sort of the Trump lens that we're looking at everything through has shifted everything. So it's a relevant time to be doing it, but also a time when I think people need comedy. And that's one of my favorite things about the show. And one of the reasons we've certainly wanted to do it is that it tackles serious issues, but there still are a lot of belly laughs, which I think people need right now.
I agree. And Lane, you play Jimmy, and you give us, again, some of that great delivery that I just have come to be associated with you. You give us some of those moments of laughter, as do your cast members. I have a question for you, but first, we talked before we started the taping. You have never met Topher, so I don't know. It's kind of an unusual thing, I think, when an actor is right there with the playwright and talking. So anything you'd like to say to Topher about your feeling about doing the show and how it's impacting you?
I mean, mainly just thank you. It's such an amazing script, and from day one, we all sat down and started working on it. We're just like, this is a really special thing to get to work on. And thank you for the words.
and by the way, if they're not cast, would you like Topher to cast you in one of the Hallmark movies coming up?
Yeah, I mean, you call me in if you want, and we'll see where it goes. But, yeah.
All right. I'm also available, Topher, if you're looking for, middle-aged, suburban, Jewish kind of guy.
Talk to the producers, Frazier. I know where your heart lies.
Yes. I know David Hyde Pierce. That's as close as I can get. Anyway, Lane, but one of the lines that you have in the show, and so much so it struck me, and I made a note of it, you say, our government is telling us by official order to despise us, to find us, to remove us from society. That's you talking about yourself and the friends that you're with. How bothersome is it as an actor to have to read lines like that and say lines like that in character?
I mean, I wouldn't call it bothersome.
Okay.
I would say that sometimes it can be very intimidating, just because it's, I mean, that moment, especially throughout the entire process, has been one for me that's, it's one of those great lines that you want to nail, and you can't force that to happen in any sort of art form, so you just, like, do it with your best shot and hope that it lands, and you can't assume that an audience is going to take it the way that you take it, but hope that they hear it.
Yeah. And Lane, let me come to you, Lane. Give us there's primarily six kind of main characters here, seven. But talk to me about the different couples and I just mean generally speaking the personality. So there's you and Norma, and if you were to give a sentence that describes you and her, what would it be as a couple?
Ooh, a sentence.
Well, that was my way of saying just we'll stay
the way with it. The way we've kind of crafted it, it's a little bit like big sister, little brother.
Oh, okay.
Kind of one of the dynamics that we have going with that.
Topher, let's get Topher, fair enough for them to view it that way?
Absolutely. I think the Baxters, you know, in this, you know, the personality that they have constructed for themselves in public, as well as just how these two relate to each other as friends, I took a lot of inspiration from Millie and Jerry Helper from the Dick Van Dyke Show, the Next Door Neighbors.
Yeah.
And where it is, you know, the wisecracking husband, and then the wife is a little more of a broad, you know, she's a wisecracking dame, and it's clear who wears the pants in that house. And having some fun with that trope.
By the way, you know, it's funny when you said that, because this is so great, right? How often do you get to have the playwright and ask him about it? Usually after, you know, because they're dead. But here you are.
Yeah.
So
yeah, I'm glad you're not dead.
Yeah, I'm really glad you're around. Although after the Hallmark movies, I'm not sure. But so the fact that they were named Baxter, I actually wondered that. You said the Dick Van Dyke Neighbors, and I was going to go, is this about George and what's her name, Baxter from Hazel? Because I kind of, to me, it was reminiscent of that. Did that occur to you at all?
And I did not make that connection until probably the second or third production when somebody pointed it out.
Okay.
But I don't know how aware I am of things. I didn't even realize the closet was an allegory until we were well into workshops.
Really? And I had a note about that very point, about there's an awful lot of people coming in and out of that closet, and indeed, it's more than just a closet on set. In fact, actually, Derek, let me ask you. There's times people go in that closet, but it looks like there's also, if there's a back door out, is that meant to be a closet but also a way out of the apartment?
Yes, it actually connects directly to the apartment next door. So that's their way to get back and forth without being seen by the public.
Gotcha. That's what I suspected, but I kept seeing that clothes rod in there, and I kind of wondered, are they just staying in, you know, are they just caught in there?
Well, yeah, they got a camouflage.
Yeah, right, that's right.
Lives in a closet.
That's exactly. So another couple, Mildred and Bob. Topher, tell us how you would, in a sentence, describe that couple.
They are, they're Lucy and Ricky, they're Rob and Laura.
I knew you were going to say that.
Ozzie and Harriet, they're the most aspirational, perfect vision of early 1950s domesticity imaginable. They live in a layout from House Beautiful and are always impeccably and aspirationally dressed.
And by the way, the casting, and Derek, I want to ask you this, the casting of Riley, now I want to get her last name right, Mondragon?
Yes, Mondragon.
Mondragon. Riley Mondragon, you know, is, and we can say that, I mean, a transgendered actor, but yet that's not relevant to the show. I mean, it just sort of is, and I just kind of compliment you in the casting. It's very Hamiltonian of you in terms of just saying, you know what, we're picking the best person for the role, I think, and that was just an irrelevant piece until I'm bringing it up.
Yeah, I mean, with Riley specifically, Riley is an artist I've wanted to work with for a while, and she's auditioned for a few different Pride Films and Plays projects, including a show I was putting together last year that kind of dealt with gender issues and just kind of like using, we basically queered Midsummer to make fairies like this genderless race. That's a whole different ball of wax, though. But with this show specifically, what I was excited about was to be able to cast Riley in a role that did not necessarily call attention to her being trans. And she, I mean, really just came in and had such a wonderful audition. And I told her, you know, one of the things that I loved was I, you know, kind of spent 2 days full of auditions talking to cis women about this idea of the 1950s housewife facade. And when Riley came in, there was just such a an ease to this to the style. And when, you know, we talked a bit more about it, and I talked to Topher about it as well. What this show is about so much is people trying to pass, and whether that's pass for being heterosexual, pass for being a certain gender or a certain type of person. So any actor who could bring this real life experience of just like on the daily, just kind of having to think about how they present themselves to the world in such a day to day way, was just really an extra layer that we could add to the show that didn't necessarily have to even be a conscious thing in the script.
Yeah, and there's a line in the show about the House of Cards inevitably falling, Lane. I don't recall whether that was your line or not.
Oh, no, that was the Barbara Grant.
Barbara Grant's line, who, of course, is that, well, all right, quickly tell us who Barbara Grant is. We don't want to say the name without saying who she is, Lane.
She's the star. She's the one. What is it, Derek, that you always say that everyone wants to be her for Halloween? She wears Balenciaga.
I stole that directly from Topher. Topher says, he has his way, we'll all be dressing like Barbara Grant for Halloween next year.
I'm going to dress her like a dream, guys.
Yeah, who knows what's in that hat box? we never did see it. But Lane, what I want to ask you, when you came out for the curtain call at the end, it seemed to me you were teared up. But first of all, we're not going to say what the ending of the show is, but I'm not going to call it a happy ending to this show. Everybody doesn't necessarily live happily ever after. People can see the show to see how it ends. But you walk out for your curtain call, and you looked emotional to me. Is that real?
Yeah. I'm trying to hide it at that point. Pull my crap back together.
Well, you didn't do a good job. So how about that? No. Actually, I'm giving that to you as a compliment, because that seeing you that way actually impacted me in the audience. So I think that's a good thing. But I wanted to get your sense of that as an actor. You do this every night, and so there you are. Nevertheless, still impacted by that by performing that role.
Yeah. There's some heightened emotions going on there at the end, and I think we're all feeling it a little bit. But it's okay. We have a bottle of whiskey in the back that we're ready to go.
Well, I assume that whiskey, I assume the drink, everybody's kind of drinking out throughout that entire show. There's real alcohol in there, right, Derek?
A little bit.
Okay.
Good God. If we drank like the people did in the early 50s, they wouldn't make it to the end of the first act.
Yeah. By the way, which also triggered me. Topher, you must have Mad Men in your background as well in terms of some influence here. Yes, no?
No, just a bunch of heavy Scottish drinkers in my family.
Okay. So let me get this sense, because for me, I walked out. Actually, I kind of sat in my chair for a while after the show was over, because there is this sense of I wanted the ending to be happier than it was, and you know, talk with my friend a little bit about what it all meant. Topher, what do you want people, when people do leave that show, what do you want them to be thinking about or get out of it?
I think with, with any period piece, it's always a question of, it's not about them then, it's about us now. And going back to your original question about the experience of writing it in 2013 and then watching what I thought was a very strong uptick of progress, take a couple of hits to the gut, it's questioning, the how we can stand together more effectively. I think the arrangement, imperfect arrangement, does not really start to fall apart until they start to turn on each other. And the central question of the play for me is always, when is good enough no longer good enough? And each character in the play, to varying degrees, is forced to confront that. And I would hope the audience would be able to take that away from the experience as well.
Derek, as you direct it and you get audience reaction to it, are you getting what Topher wants to see us get out of the show?
I think so. I think we strived really hard to not make anyone in the show a villain necessarily, but to make each character as complex as possible so the audience could really first identify with any character in the show they choose to, but also to really be able to ask those questions. Because I think so many of us who are part of the LGBTQ community or allies of the community are really kind of having to self-examine right now as far as what it means to be an ally and where each individual's privileges. And as far as, you know, as the community becomes more diverse and becomes more complex and we add letters to our alphabet, you know, and we find that certain sections of the community are a little more targeted than others, I think that's just something that's happening right now. Kind of like Topher was saying, I think each character in the show has a moment in the show where they really have to question whether good enough is good enough and whether it's better to act or to be silent, which is extremely relevant right now.
And Lane, I noticed as I was watching the show, when there, you know, there's so many just powerful lines throughout the show, and they're powerful lines of strength or who we want to be or we will overcome this kind of stuff sort of lines. And I was watching audience members, in particular, I had one woman in mind who was sitting in the front when I was there, and she was almost interacting with the cast, almost just really reacting to the lines and where she was agreeing. And you know, she wasn't speaking out loud, but you could just see she was having this reaction. You saw a lot of people sort of engrossed in that. So, Lane, I'm just curious, how do you play off of audience intensity, audience reaction throughout the show? Does it matter to you, or are you in your own world?
A little bit of both, honestly. I mean, I believe and have always approached theater as being a communal event that everyone comes to and everyone is a part of. It's not like going to a movie where there's a separation between the artists and the audience, that they're there to give their energy and be a part of it, and we're there to tell them a story, so... I always really, really value not necessarily audience interaction, like making them come up on stage and do something with me, but...
thank God, I'll run for the exit.
I know, right?
Really, like, I was waiting for the audience participation moment.
Yeah.
They do it in hair, you know.
The more present we can be, I think.
Yeah, and obviously it's important, and of course different than doing a film, like a Hallmark movie, for example. It would be different.
Sure.
Well, I want to thank all of you. What a great accomplishment to get all of you together on one interview. Topher Payne, who created The Perfect Arrangement, congratulations! It's just such a great show, does it go on anywhere from here that you know of yet? From Chicago?
Oh yeah, we're in Memphis, Dallas, St. Louis, Atlanta, Columbus, Georgia. Those are the first ones. Kansas. We're going to Kansas, North Carolina. It's having a very busy year.
Okay, but we don't want to fly to see these. We're going to see it here. We're going to see it by October
22nd.
We're going to see it by October 22nd.
See it again.
And then we'll come out to Kansas. Maybe not. Lane, you want to go to Kansas with me?
I mean, I've never been to Kansas.
It ain't Kansas anymore. All right. Lane Flores and Derek Van Barum, great direction of this show. Wonderfully done. You can get tickets at Pride. Why do I keep saying Pride? PrideFilmsAndPlays.com. PrideFilmsAndPlays.com. It's playing through October 22nd up at 4139 North Broadway at the building called the Broadway, but it's at the Pride Arts Center as well. What a contribution to the community all that is going on at that center does. And so my thanks to all of you. My congratulations to all of you, and I hope our listeners will get out there by October 22nd and see Perfect Arrangement, because it's really a great show. Thank you, guys.
Thank you so much
for your time.
Well, if you want to know more about what we've talked about here, follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, at Paul Lisnek. That's PaulLisnek. And I'd love to hear your comments or topic suggestions for future podcasts. You can also go to my website, paullisnek.tv. And hey, don't forget to hit subscribe on WGN Plus and iTunes. And tune in each week to hear more insider scoop coming to you from behind the curtain.